I'll have more to say about the unmasking of General Flynn in another commentary after completing research on what's just been revealed. What we are seeing, finally, is an unmasking of the Obama-Biden administration. Evidence shows that Barack Hussein Obama's hand was in the framing of General Flynn, and Joe Biden is up to his elbows in it. Biden lied again on Wednesday when, in an interview with George Stephanopoulos, he said that he knew nothing about the unmasking of the general. Oddly enough, Stephanopoulos, who is closer to the Clintons than Chelsea, pointed out to him that Biden had been in the meeting at the White House with Obama, James Comey, and Sally Yates, where General Flynn was discussed. Biden then stammered and lied again. In fact, Joe Biden had requested information on General Flynn just 8 days before Biden left office. It was illegal to give Biden Flynn's name. But why on earth was Biden trying to unmask Flynn just a week before he left office? Unless it was to set the general up with Comey's FBI insiders to destroy Flynn and his family. This is serious business. Biden tries to say this news is just a diversion from COVID-19 news. But the coronavirus is being covered 24/7. Nothing's going to cause a diversion from that news. There has been no diversion. Besides, COVID-19 is not Donald Trump's virus. It is the country's pandemic. Joe Biden is a cooked goose politically. All that is left of him is smoldering tail feathers. But Biden was just an Obama flunky. Barack Hussein Obama, along with Biden, needs to be called to testify under oath about what they knew and when they knew it. Sally Yates has already testified that she left that White House meeting stunned that Obama and Biden had unmasked General Flynn. As Obama's racist pastor said one time, "The chickens are coming home to roost." Just a quick word about the coronavirus before my commentary. Democrats have seen this pandemic as a means of weakening the president and, in so doing, weakening America itself. The longer the country stays shut down and the more taxpayer money we throw at it, the Democrats think that means a win for their party. This country has got to get back to work. We have to do it as safely as possible. But we cannot continue to incur more and more debt to pay people to stay home from work. When the debt was $23 trillion, financial experts were frank to admit that it was unsustainable. With this pandemic upon us, Pelosi and the Democrats have loaded stimulus bills with pet projects that have nothing to do with the virus. As I speak, Pelosi has submitted more stimulus round, $3 trillion, which includes help for immigrants that do not qualify. Illegals. It's going to be difficult to get people who are being paid $600 a week from the federal government and $200 to $300 a week from the state not to work, getting them to go back for $20,000 to $30,000 a year. Somebody's going to have to pay this debt, and that somebody is our children and grandchildren. During my research, I found other research and comments from Edward Huggins of Atlas Society, and I'll incorporate what he discovered into this commentary. During this stay-at-home period forced upon us by COVID-19, I've spent many hours a day in research for my weekly commentaries. That's nothing new. But when you can't get out, you feel confined. And I thank each of you for listening each week. In my 77-plus years on this earth, I've watched my country change. Some of those changes were good, And I'll point out that today, but much of the change threatens our ability to remain the world's greatest country. Born in 1942, while war raged across the world, I've experienced the ups and downs of ordinary life. I'm old enough to remember when the American people exemplified the American spirit of personal responsibility. Growing up in a family of six children, with a mother and father who scrambled to make ends meet, I saw them survive without government assistance programs. No free school lunches for us, no food stamps, no affordable housing provided from taxpayers. We children did get required shots from the county health department, but by and large, families of that time were responsible for taking care of themselves. There was a pioneering spirit that was inherited from our forefathers, who knew that depending upon government was a fool's mission. Today, when the word pioneer is mentioned, thoughts turn to covered wagons headed west and Indian wars. But pioneers are individuals who are dissatisfied with the status quo and seek to change it, to better it. Pioneers take responsibility for their own lives and futures. Someone's choice to bring numerous children into the world should not then depend upon government to take care of those children. Immigrants who break our laws to illegally slip into our country have no right to expect American taxpayers to take care of them. Government has no money of its own, just what it takes from taxpayers who have their own responsibilities. Pioneers are risk takers who have the courage to travel down untrodden paths and into perilous territory to reach goals they set for themselves. And as a result of their efforts, pioneers make life better and more fulfilling for themselves, and they make the world a better place for everyone else. Perhaps you yawn that, yeah, I've heard that America was a pioneering nation, but the days of covered wagons crossing the prairie are gone, and our prehistoric ancestors are gone with them. So what does all this pioneer stuff have to do with today? Well, are you concerned that living standards in this country may have peaked and are now on the way down? Concerned about your kids' education? Wish you didn't have to pay a pile of money for the most expensive houses in top-taxed neighborhoods so your little ones can go to an above-average but still not so great public school? Or that you're paying taxes for those schools even though you are spending lots of extra out-of-pocket bucks for a better private school for your own children? Concerned that Obamacare makes the delivery of medical services as bad as services offered at your local motor vehicle administration? Well, then you'd better hope that America has a pioneer-friendly future. But sadly, our pioneering culture is under assault and is eroding. We'll start with the fact that America is a nation settled by immigrants. Between 1860 and 1930, the foreign-born portion of the United States population averaged 13.6%. In 1910, some 14.8%. And more than one in seven individuals in the United States was foreign-born. With native-born spouses of immigrants, children, and grandchildren, the portion of households and families that included immigrants was well over half the population. In 2003, it was estimated 33.5 million people, or 11.7% of a population of 300 million people, was still a pretty high proportion. America's culture, until recent times, reflected the pioneer spirit of those immigrants. Those immigrants were dissatisfied with the poverty, repression, or lack of opportunity in the old country, and they sought something better. They wanted their own farms or businesses to work for themselves, to be their own bosses, to live free. Likewise, early pioneers literally risked their lives in long, cramped ocean voyages or in wagon trains heading west in the face of hostile terrain, weather, and natives. And they had to be innovators, on the spot, figuring out how to cross rushing rivers, deep canyons, or high mountains. They had to find food and water where little was available. They had to build shelters out of whatever they could find. Those settling in treeless areas became sodbusters, cutting out blocks of the packed-down mud and decayed vegetation below their feet to construct their houses. Of course, individuals could be pioneers and discoverers without traveling across physical frontiers, but these were a different type of immigrant. They came here to give and build, not with hands outstretched expecting government to take care of them. In America, innovators sought fortune and the joy of achievement by pioneering new products and innovations. Their inventions are so familiar that we forget how they transformed our world. Benjamin Franklin invented a stove that heated American homes. He invented bifocals that many of us wear on our noses to this day. In 1876, Alexander Graham Bell gave us the telephone. Can anybody today imagine a world in which all communications are only via written letters or the dots and dashes of Morse code? Henry Ford did not invent the automobile, but he did create a new way to manufacture them. He used standardized, interchangeable parts, and starting in 1913, a moving assembly line, with workers at each station along the way performing a single function in a set order to cut the time for producing a single vehicle by over 85% compared to previous methods. This meant that millions of Americans could now afford his cars. In 1906, Willis Carrier gave us the air conditioner. Anybody living south of Minnesota and Vermont should build shrines in which to give thanks to this man for the cool comfort during the blazing hot summer months. Steve Jobs gave us the personal computer when no one could imagine an alternative to huge, expensive mainframes, or imagine why anybody but a handful of scientists would even want computers anyway. Pioneers not only bet against conventional wisdom with their inventions and innovations, they also created new ways of getting goods and services to consumers. In 1888, Richard Sears and Alva Roebuck published the first Sears catalog, and soon millions of copies were distributed throughout the country. This allowed anyone in still heavily rural America to have access through the mail to a variety of products unavailable in small, local, general stores. In 1962, Sam Walton opened the first Walmart to provide direct access to a wide range of products for those many small-town Americans not in reach of another American innovation, the shopping mall. There are now more than 8,500 Walmart outlets. In 1973, Frederick Smith began operations of Federal Express to offer one of the few services, overnight or expedited emergency delivery, that was allowed as an exception to the government's postal monopoly. As a college student, Smith had received a poor grade when he presented his student project plan for such a business, but he stuck to his independent vision and revolutionized express delivery. Then, with the computer and Internet revolution, Jeff Bezos went online in 1995 with Amazon.com as an alternative to brick-and-mortar bookstores. Kindles, Nooks, and other e-book readers might soon make the paper versions obsolete. And there could be an alternative to brick-and-mortar stores for Americans to purchase those PC computers that have revolutionized information and technology. In 1996, Michael Dell began selling computers that could be customized and ordered online for delivery directly to any home or business. So it might sound like the pioneer spirit is alive and well in America, and in many ways it still is. Most Americans certainly desire better lives for themselves and appreciate the consumer products that flood our Best Buys. We are familiar with the end products of the spirit, but we would do well to reflect, for example, upon the spirit of Silicon Valley that produced them. Reflect on all the discoveries and inventions, including many trials and failures, that went into producing the communications and information revolution. Consider all the drives, switches, data storage devices, and software that go into any desktop, laptop, or handheld device. But that's in spite of the pioneering spirit in sectors of the economy, country, and culture, and from government policies that reinforce the worst in one another. To begin with, there is a growing risk aversion in our culture. The environmentalist movement is notable for giving us the precautionary principle. That's the notion that if products or new production processes pose any sort of risk, often highly speculative or vague ones, unsupported by any sound science, then such products or processes must be banned. The burden should be placed on the pioneer to prove that no harm to humans, or more often to that floating abstraction called the environment, will result from their innovations. We see excessive risk aversion, too, in so-called helicopter parents. These are parents who hover over their children, attempting to shield their kids from every risk, every discomfort, and every experience at which the child could possibly fail. They see dangers to their children everywhere. They restrict their children's outdoor activities, where they can go, and with whom they can associate. They monitor and track their children's activities like Big Brother. It is certainly understandable that in any advanced, prosperous society, parents will attempt to protect their children from unnecessary dangers to health and public safety. But obsessive attempts will ensure that children never become truly functioning adults and create a stagnant culture bereft of innovations. Timid and frightened hearts can spin scores of scenarios of unknown perils lurking in every new idea. It's impossible for the innovator to prove a negative, to imagine every threat and then counter it. The deadly effects of the precautionary principle are seen most starkly in the requirement that creators of new pharmaceutical products certify to the Food and Drug Administration not only that their products are safe, but also that they are effective. The result is that it can take a decade or more to get new life-saving products to market at hundreds of millions of extra dollars in cost. That research and development cost is then passed on in every increasing drug cost purchase. Further, thousands of individuals die while products that could have saved lives are being tested one more time. Some 119,000 Americans who might have been saved by the heart medication beta blockers died during that product's 7-year certification period. And 25,000 died of cancer during the 3.5-year period for certifying interleukin-2. Unwarranted precaution and hostility to risk can be very risky indeed. Today we see in the culture the destructive effects of an obsession with equality of condition and outcome. This is often motivated by envy, which discourages entrepreneurial pioneers and can translate into destructive government policies. In the 1900s, for example, as personal computers and internet access were spreading throughout the country, liberal politicians erroneously argued that we were becoming two Americas, a new elite with access to all the new technology, and a permanent underclass condemned to ignorance for lack of access to the technology of tomorrow. Of course, most public libraries were putting in computer terminals with internet access that could be used free by anyone. But of course, One problem with the so-called underclass is that too few of them would bother to take their kids to libraries in the first place. But there is a pattern for the spread of new products and technologies. At first, they're available to more prosperous customers who can afford them. But soon, competition begins to bring down the price as equality gets more even and quality rises. A look at the spread of technologies over the past century shows that access to PCs and the Internet became affordable and available to all faster than telephones and television. For example, it took 71 years for telephones to reach just half of American homes. It took 52 years for electricity and 28 years for radio, but only 19 years for personal computers and 10 years for the Internet. Personal responsibility and independence in America's culture are being replaced by attitudes of passivity and entitlement, of expecting and even demanding that someone else take care of your problem. Some style themselves as victims. Not victimized by actual criminals, thieves, or state-enforced repression or discrimination, but generally victimized by an uncaring and unsympathetic world. Another sector where pioneers are desperately needed, and yet more and more are pushed out, is the delivery of health care. For much of America's history, such services were provided privately, with insurance companies footing the bills for many catastrophic illnesses. But in 1965, Congress enacted Medicare to cover medical costs of retirees and Medicaid to cover costs for the poor. Private medical insurance for retirees disappeared within a year. Today, annual Medicare costs are almost $500 billion, and fraud in the system is rampant. Today, annual Medicaid costs are over $200 billion. Some 100 million Americans are covered by government programs, and the federal government controls the largest portion of pricing for medical services. Insurance has been controlled heavily by state governments, but Obamacare was planned to have the federal government micromanage insurance as well. Many Americans are trying to get around the inefficiencies of this broken system. Today, some 750,000 Americans seek medical care in other countries, paid for out of their own pockets. In India, for example, there's a growing number of English-speaking physicians, often having been trained in the United States or Great Britain, who provide quality services at just a fraction of the cost in the States. Our physicians are licensed under rules mandated by state governments and cannot practice in other states without securing licenses there as well. But what if our physicians could offer services online and across state lines? What sort of system might some pioneer create to employ on-site exams plus remote diagnostics? Could there be a Sam Walton, a Jeff Bezos, or a Michael Dell who could set up a system that we cannot today imagine, but that could cut medical costs while delivering improved and timely treatments? America's pioneering spirit is still alive, but it is being worn down by a risk-averse culture that promotes the abrogation of personal responsibility and that promotes public consensus over independent judgment. It is worn down by the enemy of all progress and pioneers, an overweening and power-hungry government. For instance, what would American education look like if the government were to leave it to the private sector pioneers who are seeking new ways to teach our children how to think and give them the unbiased knowledge they need for a happy, flourishing life. Our schools might cease to look like what they have been for the past 100 years. If we continue to allow government to control our lives, we become conditioned to expect little from ourselves and everything from government. We demand to make our own choices in our lives, but refuse to take responsibility for the bad choices that we make. Your neighbor owes you nothing except peace and harmony. The rest is up to each of us. We do not have enough money to continue to pay people to stay out of work. There is a give and take at play here. Democrats only want to give. First they take, and then they give to somebody else. Here's the truth. Democrats have suggested that we pay people $1,000 a month for a year after this pandemic passes, assuming, of course, that it passes. Other so-called scientists have said that it may never pass. We may never have a vaccine against COVID-19. I don't believe that, but it has been said. If that is true, how do we give everybody $1,000 a month for the rest of their lives and the rest of our lives? How do we pay that debt back? And the answer is, of course, we can't. Democrats don't think about those kind of things when they're trying to buy votes. I hope you'll pay attention to something other than the traditional mainstream news media for your news. They don't give you news. They give you their biased opinions. They give you political opinions. They give you Democrat opinions. Watch any of them. ABC, NBC, CBS. ABC's Jonathan Carl has pretty much driven me away from even watching ABC News at 6:30. The man hates Donald Trump. And that's fine. That's his business. If he wants to hate Trump, he can hate Trump. But he has no right to skew the news trying to make you and me hate Trump. Thank you for listening today. I'll be back again next week. Same time, same station, God willing.